It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod, recorded on May 21st, 2024. And in the pod with me this time is Chuck McMinn. Thanks for being in the pod.
Happy to be here, Barry.
So you've been in Napa Valley for about 20 years now, right?
20 years full time, yeah.
What brought you here?
Serendipity. We thought we were looking for a weekend house. And in the space of looking over the course of 2019, we became aware that Vineyard 29 might be for sale. And instead of being here on the weekends, we decided we could be here full time. And in the space of 2 weeks, we went from weekend house looker to owner of Vineyard 29.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were looking for a weekend house because you were living in Silicon Valley?
Silicon Valley for 25 years, mm-hmm. and had been involved in all kind of different seats at the table for startups for many, many years, and didn't really think I was going to cut the tie with that totally. But when the opportunity to buy Vineyard 29 came up, we said, well, why not? I mean, I was fortunate to have done a couple of successful startups in Silicon Valley, and it was a case of, do I want to do that for the third or fourth time, or do I want to try to do something different in a startup in an entirely different business in a beautiful valley with a great community? And we said, why not?
Before, I want to rewind back to 75 and start mm-hmm. from there, but tell us about Vineyard 29 for a moment.
So in 2000, Vineyard 29 was a small 500-case winery. It was started by Tom Payne and Teresa Norton. And it was started in kind of the optimal way. I mean, it was cuttings from Dick and Ann Grace's vineyard next door. It was planted by David Abreu. The wine was made by Heidi Barrett. And it was marketed to Dick and Ann Grace's mailing list. So it was sold out from day one. And that all came about because Tom was standing down at the road with Dick and saying, well, maybe I'll plant some fruit trees here. And, you know, Dick's told him he was crazy. This is prime Cabernet country. So it's us, and then to the north, Dick and Ann Grace, and then to the north of them, Colgan's Tixon Hill Vineyard. So it's this very unique little slope on the western side of Highway 29, right in the point in the valley that's the narrowest. So it's kind of a very unique terroir. And, mm-hmm. And so they built it up, but they had done that in their retirement. And in 2000, they made the decision that the next step for them was to build a winery, but it wouldn't have payback in their lifetime. So they instead were willing to sell us the project. Mm-hmm. And for us, it was like, well, all we got to do is not screw it up. I mean, it's got a great brand, great packaging, great pedigree. And so we've been able since then to grow it from 500 cases to about 11,000, and still almost 70%, 75% direct to our customers, that some of which have been with us since the very first vintage in 1992. So it's been a wonderful experience.
Now, anybody who would take the risks that are involved in a winery property like that and a vineyard property has to have been seduced by wine at some point in the past, right? To where you lose all your good judgment.
Yes.
When did that happen?
So for me, that happened in between 1996 1986 and 1992, when I was in the venture capital business. I didn't know anything about wine before that. You know, we used to have the box of apple juice for the kids and the box of wine for us in the refrigerator, but the partners there were into drinking good wines, and they got me hooked on drinking good wines, and I would make the trip, you know, some of the wine shops down on the peninsula over and over again. So,
mm-hmm. And day tripping up to Napa Valley? Yes,
some day tripping up mm-hmm. to, but I didn't, not so much, not, you know, we did, when we first came to Silicon Valley in the early 70s, I would come up, but we didn't routinely come up to wineries. I did most of the wine purchasing at retail. But Dan Lynch, rest his soul, just passed away here, was my first outside investor at one of the companies that I started. And when it went public, he invited me up to the wine auction in 99 and introduced me to all the winemakers and all the vineyard owners. And I said, this is a great community. I'd love to be involved in it.
Yeah. Was there a particular bottle that really flipped your switch? I know I have one wine that I tasted that just lit me up.
So the first 6 liter. So part of the deal with Dan Lynch was that after I had started the company Covad Communications, and when it went public, my present to myself and my wife was to build a wine cellar in our house in Los Altos Hills, and the first large format bottle of wine that I ever bought for that wine cellar was a 6 liter of Vineyard 29 in the 1999 wine auction for the St. Leon Hospital Foundation. But Vineyard 29 was kind of, for me, you know, in the close orbit of things that I liked.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back, as I said, I'm going to circle back to 1975 or so. You were in Silicon Valley.
78. I got 78. To 78.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Prior to that, where are you from originally, and how did you end up in the Bay Area and doing that work?
Yeah. Both my wife and I grew up in Madison, New Jersey. We both went to school in New England. I went to school at Brown, Syracuse, and Harvard Business School. She went to Mount Holyoke. And in 1978, after business school, actually in the last semester of business school, Intel, for the very first time, sent a letter to the business school saying, do you think there'd be any graduates that might be interested in coming to work for us? And I responded back. They sent a recruiter out and interviewed, I don't know how many people, a day's worth, and flew me out to California and offered me the job to be the co-product manager of the 8086 microprocessor, which at the time was not yet quite announced. I got there in May of 1978, and they announced the product in June.
I don't think people may realize necessarily how early that really is in computing.
Right. I mean, it was before the IBM PC. In fact, I was the product line manager 3 years later in 1981 when the IBM PC came out. And so it was my product that was in the first computer that everybody would identify as a computer instead of, kind of a computer kit.
Mm-hmm. Did you have engineering training? Were you in that field in college or more in straight in business fields?
No, a BS and an MS in electrical engineering and an MBA.
So you had both. You had the
I had both. Side. And I even knew when I was in college that I ultimately wanted to run my own company or start my own company. And I knew it would most likely be in the tech space because that's where most opportunities to start new companies are. And coming out of business school, I said, well, my other choice of job was to be, the product manager for fiber optics at Corning Glassworks in Syracuse, New York, a lot closer to the family. But we kind of said, if we're going to do this, we should go to the heart of where technology is and work at a company that's at the heart of that, and good things will happen.
So you're looking at a roughly 50-year span here of this technological revolution. Mm-hmm. Has it turned out here in 2024 in any way that you had envisioned?
I don't think that anybody could really wrap their mind around what exponential growth means. That a doubling in the performance of a chip every 2 years, and that's Moore's Law. Doubling in performance at the same price or a decrease in price by a factor of two every 2 years. And that has gone on now for, since the 1960s. And even as the product manager of the 8088 that's in the IBM PC in the summer of 1981, I don't think that I knew, I don't think the bosses knew, I don't think Andy Grove knew the impact that having that one design win would mean. And it happened in a very serendipitous way because IBM didn't have a clue either. They had this Skunk Works project in Boca Raton, Florida that wasn't making computers, according to IBM. They were just kind of making a toy. And so they didn't make the hardware. Intel made the hardware, and they didn't make the software. They ran out and got MS-DOS from Microsoft. So after it became the business success, Intel and Microsoft could go to everybody and say, how'd you like to make something that works exactly like an IBM PC? And that really was the caused the entire industry to explode. And then just more and more performance, more and more cost effective has really, you know, led to all kind of things that I don't think we could imagine. And it's still going on. And those people who extrapolate today, you know, given this today, tomorrow is going to be worse because of AI or because of this or that or the other thing. They don't understand the things that they don't know, the possibilities that for creating benefits that that can't be envisioned until you're on top of them.
What someone famously called the unknown unknowns.
Correct. Yeah.
How long can Moore's Law continue to function as it has?
So that question has been asked almost every couple of years for the last 50 years, and they still seem to find ways to do it. Now, we all know that the doubling can't go on forever, and it's getting... The flip side is it's getting more and more expensive to do it. So at some point, even if you could do it, you may not be able to afford to do it. But it looks, I would, from my vantage point now, removed from technology, it looks like it's good for another, you know, 3, 4, 5 doublings.
There's once in a while you run across a statistic, a comparison, for example, of the computing power that Apollo 11 had,
right,
versus what we all carry in our pockets.
Oh, yes. The computer that was on the first Apollo flights had less capability than your phone by orders of magnitude. Yeah. Orders of magnitude.
As a sidebar, when I was a kid back in Missouri, my brother-in-law was a computer science major at Missouri Southern State College, and he was always packing around these sets of cards, the IBM cards, right, to feed into the machine. And resulting in, you know, like a DOS printout of Snoopy or something silly like that. This is 1972 or 3, probably. Right. And, you know, somehow I knew this was going to be a big thing, but it was so clunky and so impossible, loading programs off cassette tapes and everything would overheat. And, you know, thinking about your lifespan, my lifespan, this unbelievable amount of change and the word that is so often used now, disruption.
Right.
Did you think of yourself, did your peers think of yourselves as disruptors back then?
Yes. I'll give you a kind of a succinct example of that. At Intel, part of the job that as a product manager, you're going out to get the customer input about your next chip. And we know it's going to have twice as much performance and cost half as much. And so the mantra at Intel is you better eat your own children or somebody else will. So the mindset was that we want to make a new product that will make our old product obsolete. And that, I think, is that's the mindset you have to be in when you're in an industry that has experienced geometric growth.
You know, you wonder if Henry Ford and you know, Thomas Edison and people like that, they didn't think that way. They were thinking about creating a product that would last and would be the same for a long period of time, I imagine.
Right. Yeah, and I think that is a difference between this technology and technologies of the past. It's more about efficiency. The fundamental underlying costs of your business don't change dramatically from generation to generation, and it does in this business. But you know, but having said that, none of what I just told you about will people remember in 100 years. But they'll be using the Vine Trail for 100 years. And that's one of the wonderful things that I love about doing what I'm doing now is that it's going to have a much more long-lasting impact on individual people. Not to say that the technology has already had dramatic impact, way more than the Vine Trail will have in the world, but to attribute it to one single product or one single company, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But one single project is going to make a difference.
I mentioned that word disruptor because people in tech these days use it very proudly. And you'll hear a company launch as we're going to disrupt so-and-so sector. And there have been times when I've thought, like, I don't really want my life to be disrupted anymore. I like it the way it is. I'm not sure that, you know, Uber made my life any better and things that have upset and destroyed entire sectors of the economy. I don't think there's any way to anticipate all those things, but Have we gotten, you know, this is probably a dumb question really, but have we gotten more benefit out of this technological geometric growth than we have negativity?
So far, absolutely, that the things that are possible to do today. And I think disruptor is mostly applied not to the end customer, not to upsetting them, but in fact, delighting them while disrupting the status quo. And the company I started, Covad Communications, was an example. When we started Covad, it was to offer high-speed connections to the internet using the telephone company's copper wires. It was at a time when, after the Telecom Act of 96, when they had to share their copper wires. And they had the technology to, they were using this technology to offer high-speed connections to large businesses at a couple thousand dollars a month. We introduced our first product using similar to a next generation of a very similar technology at $200 a month. And eventually we got it to $20 a month. You know, we beat six of the seven telephone companies to market in their own territories. They were not going to do what was right for the consumer. They were going to do what was right for their stockholders and the bottom line of their company. So disruptor to me applies to the new company that's out there to break the rules that have limited the offerings to consumers. And I think if you look across the space of technological information, the end customers ended up with a lot of very tangible benefits. It is true that some jobs or some professions are disrupted in the process, and some people need to find something different to do in their career. And I think that AI is a little different because we're getting to the point now where we're not just displacing people's physical labor, but we're displacing people's mental labor, their intellectual productive capacity, and that could be fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a moment on AI because you know, I have a mixture of opinion, but some people with some very scary visions of you know, what we've seen in every science fiction movie for 50 years,
right,
where it runs amok, it takes control of humanity, and it ends up destroying humanity. Some people say that's inevitable if we don't do things to stop it. Where do you stand on that idea?
So first of all, that's not what AI does today. AI is a very good parrot, a very, very capable parrot. The way these AI systems are trained, they're trained on the entire content of the internet, and they're trained to predict, given some set of words, what's the next logical set of words to occur after that. So it's only as good as the set of words that have been fed into it, and it only can reproduce innovative combinations of the words that it has been given. But the actual intelligence is not being created in the computer. The intelligence is in the training information that are generated by real human beings that are fed into the computer. That's not to say that some of the technology that's being used now can't be used in the future to do more complicated things. I mean, for instance, you know, the difference between a cat and a dog, it takes a computer millions of images of cats and dogs to come up with their AI predictions about what's a cat and what's a dog. For a human child, it takes about a dozen. So we already know that the computers are nowhere near the optimum for how these technologies might be able to work. But and there's going to be bad uses of technology, just like there are bad uses of this technology, just like there are bad uses of any other technology. But and it deserves some regulation, just like everything deserves some regulation to make sure that we try to maximize the good stuff and minimize the bad stuff. But overall, I'm much more positive about the impact that this can have on just ordinary people's lives. You know, we and friends are going to the Rocky Mountains in August. I went on ChatGPT in January and said, give me the top 10 hotels in Banff and give me the top 10 activities. Produces a couple pages of text, including one hotel that didn't exist that it made up. And then I said, give me the distance between all the restaurants and all the hotels in my, and it gave me in kilometers. I said, make it in miles. It gave me in miles. So now I know kind of, and give me the telephone numbers and the websites for all of those. And that now, so now that was, I don't know, a day worth of work that I would have to do going through Google searches. That is the starting point for now me calling up some hotels and looking at some websites and figuring out what we wanted to do. But it was there to be filter on the internet that didn't require me and my keystrokes and my reading of websites to be that filter.
As somebody who's seriously interested in accurate information, working in the media and worrying about how easily people are duped, this seems to be one of the biggest areas of concern, the way I think about it. Like you said, it created a hotel that didn't exist or a restaurant that didn't exist.
Right.
How do we protect people from being fooled by what seem to be legitimate AI-generated results that are not true in the, right. about something more important than, say, the location of a hotel?
Right. So I think that's – so for right now, check your sources, right? Just like any newspaper report, just like any radio personality, when you say something is a fact, you better know it's a fact. And so check the sources. Don't leave it up to the machine. Don't be lazy. In the longer term, they're working on AIs that can test AIs and AIs that can look at images to see if other AIs have created them. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interesting jobs in that space, you know, of truth detectors, both mechanical and human.
It's already fueled a big job boom and stock boom for a lot of the tech companies here in the Bay Area.
Right. Oh, yes. I mean, NVIDIA went from this niche little gaming computer accelerator company to worth $1 trillion. Yeah. And I'm sure there's some mania to it. There's some tulip, you know, mania to it, but there's a lot of underlying real performance there as well. Mm-hmm. And that has happened all the time. Way back in the early computer days, there was a workstation. Everybody was into workstations. That workstations with this little, you know, super duper computer on your desk. Super, you know, there was way too many, you know, workstation companies created, and many of them went out of business. And but at the end of the day, technology moved forward, and we all have now on our phone more computing power than these super duper workstations were supposed to give us 10 or 15 years earlier.
I laugh about about $3,000 I spent on the first PC in my home.
Oh, yeah.
1994, probably.
Yeah.
I was so proud of that thing. And mainly I ran the Encarta encyclopedia off CD-ROMs.
Right.
You know, that was my joy at that time.
Right.
And once in a while, you'd try to get the modem to connect and do something online.
Right. Well, so I'm older than you were. I'll give you mine. Yeah. When I went to college, I spent $100 on a four-function calculator.
Wow.
Now it's, you know, $100. All it did was add, subtract, multiply, and divide.
That's when $100 was money.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. In today's terms, you know, I don't know, $500?
Yeah. Crazy. So, separate topic, and here kind of branching off from what we just talked about, another local effort you've been deeply involved in is Napa Learns.
Mm-hmm.
Why has that been important to you?
Yeah, so Napa Learns, we started in 2009, and it was really about getting kids the tools and the preparation for the jobs of the 21st century. At COVID, 85% of our engineering department was foreign educated. That we were not, and we still aren't, spending the level of effort to train our kids for the jobs that are going to be the ones that persist in an environment where easy things will be done by machines. We weren't spending enough. You know, when we started Napa Learns, there was still an attitude in the educational community that computers don't belong in schools. That giving a kid a computer is like giving a kid a television, and all it's going to do is turn them into, you know, vapid users, you know, just drooling in front of a TV set, you know, not thinking. But we were able very quickly to prove that that indeed was not the case. And the first thing we did, one of our first projects, was giving iPads to pre-kindergartners, in particular 17 kids in Calistoga who were selected because they hadn't had a preschool experience, and they had this 8-week boot camp in the summer before kindergarten where they were where there was some hope that they could get these kids better prepared to, you know, with those their peers who had had a preschool experience. And the four kindergarten teachers from Calistoga volunteered for the project because they were sure it wasn't going to work, and they wanted to see the results. Within a couple of weeks, they all were just over the moon about this, to the point where at the end of the summer, they said, well, what happens now? And I said, well, we'll give these kids can keep the 17 iPads through kindergarten, and we'll track them and see what to do next. And they said, oh, no, every kid, every kindergartner in Calistoga needs to have this capability. So we and the Napa Valley Office of Education came up with the money to do that. And one of the teachers there went on to get her master's degree in 21st century learning, which Napa Learns paid for at that time 100%, now 50% of the cost of getting a master's degree in 21st century teaching is paid for by Napa Learns.
And for those who are listening to this podcast and want to get involved, you can still contribute, I'm sure, to Napa Learns.
So Napa Learns merged with the Napa Valley Ed Foundation a couple of years ago, and Napa Valley Ed Foundation still continues forward the programs of this particular program for teachers. There's all kind of teacher seminars they do. They're also helping kids in other ways. The mental health of kids is a hugely important thing that the Vintners have funded through the Napa Valley Ed Foundation. Mm-hmm. They have a music program as well that touches 1,600 kids, gives them free instruments so that they can participate in music programs. So it's been great to see. And now every school has computers. Every school has decent Wi-Fi connections. You don't have to hold your computer up to the ceiling in the corner of the cafeteria to get coverage. And all the schools are connected together with multiple fiber optic links, so they have the backbone, you know, requirements. So the plumbing is put in place. The teachers have been trained so that they can help the kids, and the kids have experienced the technology, and of course they eat it up.
Absolutely. So you've got Napa Valley Education Foundation that you can support if you believe in these causes, and the Vine Trail, which we haven't talked about too much here on the podcast, but that's kind of a separate topic. We'll perhaps revisit that another time. Chuck McMinn, who has been my guest here in the Berry Pod, what a fascinating story, and thanks for all the effort you're putting into these Napa community things.
Happy to do it.
This Berry Pod recorded on May 21st, 2024.
You're listening to The Berry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 99.3, thevine.com.